Before we get started with today's show, I want to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, In the Crease, the ESPN NHL podcast with leading experts on the sport, Hall of Fame sportscaster Linda Cohn and national NHL reporter Emily Kaplan. It's every Monday and Thursday. Cohn and Kaplan will bring fans their insider perspectives, reporting, reactions, and analysis to the latest headlines and under-the-radar stories both on and off the ice. The duo will also be joined regularly by ESPN's lineup of NHL voices, as well as current NHL stars and legends of the game. That's In the Crease podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. Also, the Peabody and Emmy Award-winning 30 for 30 film series Once Upon a Time in Queens, a four-part documentary event about the city, the swagger, and the wild ride of the 1986 Mets. This documentary explores the epic tale of one of baseball's most dominant and iconoclastic teams and their legendary World Series comeback. Hear from former Mets players and fans, including Daryl Strawberry, Keith Hernandez, Bill Burr, Cindy Lauper, and more. All four parts of Once Upon a Time in Queens are available to stream on ESPN Plus and the ESPN app immediately. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. It is that time of week where we have a guest join us. You can check him out now at The Athletic, writing about and editing DC sports. You also seen him on many an NBA sideline and the star of the PTI 20 documentary that came on the other night, David Aldridge.
Bo, thank you, man. Thank you. I had no idea they were going to use as much as they did. I thought it was just going to be a little here, a little there. I don't know. It was fun to do, though. It was fun to do. Fun to reminisce for a little bit.
I'll tell you one thing I thought that was interesting about it, especially considering it was an in-house production. Like, I think the E60 people went ahead and did it. And I was like, nope, those are exactly the dudes. Like, I can't really say no because I don't kick it with them like that. But like, yeah. No, these are the guys that I know. And they're like, how do you make these two surly dudes so endearing? That is the most interesting question within the context of themselves. It's like, oh, you don't even notice. Like, yo, that dude just be mad for no reason, that stuff.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're right, but that's what makes the show work. If it was just either one, either Mike and, who I both love, by the way, Mike and Tony, if it was either one of them by themselves, the show would not have worked. Just wouldn't have worked. It would have just been somebody that many people find unpleasant dude just ranting and raving, right? But the fact that it's the two of them together, and the show is about two guys that love each other. I keep saying that. It's not about sports. It's about these two guys that really care for each other. And people watch that. People like shows where you see two people who care about each other. I can't say I expected it to last 20 years. I would say that I'm sure they wouldn't believe that either. But people like shows about people that care about each other. And they'll watch them do whatever it is that they do as long as they keep caring about each other. And that's what I think the magic of the show is.
I'm glad they had that magic because it done made me a whole lot of money. Like, they completely revolutionized what sports television was and how to do it.
Right.
PTI completely revolutionized it. And they mentioned it in the documentary, but I almost think they kind of undersold it. The rundown on the side of the screen was the first of its kind. Like, that
correct
100% changed the way that television worked. And it's so interesting because what a basic idea. Hey, why don't we put it on the screen so people know what's coming up next?
It was the first innovation that acknowledged how people watch television. People, you got the clicker in your hand, you sit down, let me look and see what's on TV. And if I'm not enthralled and I'm not engaged within a minute, I'm changing the channel to something else. And PTI was the first show that acknowledged that reality. We're going to talk about this for 90 seconds and hopefully keep your interest long enough so that you want to hear the next thing that we talk about. Instead of just saying, we're on for half an hour, you're going to watch us no matter what we talk about. And that's not how people consume television. And they understood that and they made it palatable for the kind of attention span deficit generation that was just coming of age and watching television at the time.
Well, it's almost ironic, right? Because as crotchety as they can be at times, that's a futuristic idea. Like, that is getting ahead of the way internet programming works, where internet programmers like, look, man, we're going to give you a minute and a half, 2 minutes, and then we're going to give you something else. And if we roll that next thing over just fast enough, you won't even think to go to anything else, and you'll just keep on riding out with what it is. And so Tony and Mike, the forerunners of online content.
Yes. They didn't even know they were doing it. You know, that's Rideholm. That's the producer who understood it and had the concepts of it and the vision to make it work. What Mike and Tony do bring is that kind of substance. You know what Phil Jackson used to always talk about, improvisation within structure with Michael. And it's with Jordan, it's the same thing. There's a structure that allows Tony and Mike to kind of fill in the blanks with knowledge and with passionate argument that makes the show work. You know, if it was just, again, two dudes that didn't know anything talking about sports, it wouldn't work. The fact that those two guys had been sports writers and sports columnists for so long, even if you disagree with them, you couldn't say they didn't know what they were talking about, for the most part. And I think that's, again, the magic and the beauty of that show, is that there's substance within that structure that Rideholm put together.
Yeah, and the great contrast between the two of them, I think it was Reality who said it once, the biggest difference between the two of them is Tony Kornheiser doesn't really like being Tony Kornheiser. Michael Wilbon loves being Michael Wilbon.
I think those are very true words from Tony. Yes, that's absolutely correct. Anybody that knows them understands that completely and agrees with it completely.
Yeah, you know, and it was interesting for me with Wilbon. You know, I don't know either of them particularly well, but mm-hmm. I've known them after like PTI became this like super duper established sort of thing. And Michael Wilbon walks in a room and Michael Wilbon owns that room, right? And I was like, oh, okay, this is what happens when you're on television. What I didn't realize is, no, that's how Michael Wilbon saw it when he walked in every room prior to that also. I completely misunderstood. And it works out well, man, because I ain't never paid for nothing in his presence, ever. And I don't know if he's paid either.
Yeah, right. No, I can tell you, believe me, Bo, I can tell you, as somebody who's known Mike for, God, 35 years now, it was that way before PTI. Mike loves being Mike. I'll just put it that way.
Yeah.
enjoys it, lives in it comfortably, and wants you to enjoy it too. It's not like he's a standoffish dude. It's like, don't talk to me. No, he wants you to talk to him. He wants to argue. He wants to yell. He wants to scream. And he wants to pick up the check. So that's what happens when you're in his orbit.
Man, I actually thought about this. I was like, I don't know what Mike would have to send to Bristol for them to look at his expense report and be like, okay, that's too far. Right? Like what gets Michael Wilbon's expenses called through? The answer is nothing. Nothing at all. Because I went to dinner with him in Miami when I first moved there. So this is 2013, and I'm just kind of becoming, for lack of a better term, somebody. And I'm with him, and we went to Prime. And Prime, if you've never been to Prime 112, they got this legendary $26 bowl of lobster bisque on the menu, which to me, even to this day, is like $26 for a bowl of soup. I can't believe this. But I'm with Wilbon, so I'm like, you know, I'm new to this. I'm going to get the $26 bowl of lobster bisque. And I did, and it comes to the end, I'm pulling out my wallet. He's looking at me like I'm pulling out my middle finger. Like this concept, this idea that like, no, dude, I'm going to pay for this. But it's entirely possible that Miles paid for it. Because when you, the weirdest thing about getting on and getting money is people like to buy you stuff when you don't even notice that you're spending the money.
It's crazy. You're perfectly willing to go to 112 and drop several hundred dollars. Like, you get that. If you walk in the door, that's what you're going to do, right? And it's okay. It's the experience, it's all of the ambiance and everything. You'll do it because it's worth it to you. And then they say, no, we got it. And it just tells you, you just go, what? What? You know what I mean? Like no, I'm willing to pay this outrageous $26 for a bowl of soup. I'm willing to do it. And they say, no, I'll put your money away. It's no good. In fact, we're going to give you a dessert on top of it. So that's
See, that's the thing. I got to move up to it. I am not at the your money is no good here place. I'm at the compliments of the chef place. Like, oh, I appreciate that appetizer. Wow, a dessert. That would be really cool. But I got to start making more money before I can get to the this is on the house portion of the program.
Yeah, no, I'm not there either. But I have dreams of someday being there.
Yeah, no, I think we got it right. We got homies that can get you to that place, right? Like if I go places with Dan in Miami, that's probably how it's going to wind up getting down. Dan don't have to pay for nothing, even though he would pay for it.
He would, of course. But when you're wired, you know, when Wilbon's in Chicago, you know how this is going to go. You just know how the evening's going to go, and you just kind of hang on to the comment as long as you can.
Right. Then, like I said, like you've known him for years. I don't even really know him like that, and I don't be paying for nothing, right? And I'm not like young and sparkly anymore where it's like, oh, you can't expect the youngster to pay for his food. No, you can't. It just ain't going to happen, and it could be 15, 20 people. Exactly. It still ain't going to happen. And by the way, 15, 20 people, it still might get comped.
It's like going out with Barkley. Just like, and the thing that's about Barkley, and it's similar to Wilbon, but there are nights where Mike does go home and read a book. There are some. Chuck's out every night. And this is every night for Charles Barkley for the last 30 years. Every night. It's the same. He buys everybody's dinner. He buys everybody's drinks. And it's every night. And that's what's remarkable about him, is that he is the most comfortable superstar in his skin that I've ever seen, I've ever known. I've never seen him say no to an autograph or a picture or anything, ever, ever. And I've been out with him, I don't know, a few dozen times over the years. People who like to live in the public, they're like that. And Mike and Chuck are people like that. Tony is not. You gonna pay when you go out with Tony.
It's funny that you mentioned that about Charles, because Bruce Feldman once said it best. He was like, Charles Barkley's better at being famous than anybody that I've ever been around. Just the nicest dude in the world. I had to explain to somebody. I think another buddy of mine and I were talking about this once, because his wife had, you know, just a certain contempt for Charles, because she's not really a sports person. She's hears some of the out there things Charles can say. Yeah. And it's just like, Charles has said things that I have found noxious and problematic and everything else. And I don't know how bad the thing is that he would have to say for me to be like, I'm not riding with Charles Barkley. Right. Charles is the nicest dude, most nicest giving dude, dude you'll ever come across.
Yes, absolutely. And to complete strangers, I mean, total complete strangers, people that would otherwise have nothing to do with a large, loud black man will gravitate to Chuck and just think that they're best friends, you know, because Chuck, he welcomes people into his world like no other superstar. And he is a superstar. You know this, Bo. Chuck is a superstar. He's not a guy that played in the league for 7 years. There's tons of guys that played in the league for 7 years. Chuck's one of the best players ever. And then he became one of the best broadcasters ever. You know what I mean? So you would expect him to have the walled off room with the security guards out front and you can only let 8 people in. It's not like that. He's sitting at the bar, man. He's just standing at the bar, just talking to some couple that just got married. Oh, where y'all from? Oh, we're from Missouri. Oh, that's great. You know, and it just is unbelievable. It's unbelievable. Yeah. I've seen it happen too many times for it to be an act. It's not an act.
One of my buddies said, I want to say like 95. I think it was 95 because I think he was on his senior trip. And he's from, you know how people think that when they talk about Northern California and they're talking about the Bay, but they don't realize, oh, no, there's a lot more north of that, right? He's from one of those towns that's up there north of that. And so they went to San Francisco for like, you know, a class trip for the weekend. And I guess the Suns were in town to play the Warriors, and they saw Charles Barkley. So it is a gaggle of teenagers, and they see Charles Barkley at the height of Charles Barkley fame. Charles was willing. They said no, but Charles was like, you guys want to go get something to eat or whatever? And he was just going to go hang out with these high school seniors and pay for their food. And they just didn't understand that he meant it. Yeah. That, like, no, guys, you could have done this, and you would have gone to the best restaurant you ever have and had a ball and just rolled out.
He loves meeting people. He loves it. He loves meeting and talking to people. There is no sense that he is wasting his time or that he's bored or that he is ill-tempered and wants to get this over with so he can get back to his room. It's not, no, Chuck likes to hang out. He really does. He's like a politician almost. They get energy from talking and meeting people that allows them to kind of get through that evening. I don't even think it's like adrenaline. It's not that, because he's not a guy that's going to jump out of a plane. You know what I mean? Like, he just likes people. He's a people person. This is amazing.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Well, you mentioned something in that, which will help us transition to actual basketball, but a smooth way, where you mentioned him being one of the greatest players ever. How does it feel to realize that we're at that point in our lives where we have to explain to people, oh, no, you don't understand. There was one of those.
Yeah.
Just one. Like, you'll look it up, and the numbers will tell you that Karl Malone put up all these biggest numbers and everything else, and that's fine. But Karl Malone, as good as he was not that guy.
No, not 6'4¾". I'm going to charitably say Chuck was 6'4¾". You know, just getting 19 rebounds a game. You know what I mean? Just outlandishly lead the break, finishing. No, Chuck was a problem now. Y'all got to understand how good Chuck was back in the day. They don't just give out MVP awards. You know what I mean? Like, he was that dude for a long time on good but not great Philly teams. And then a couple of really good Phoenix teams, one of which got to the finals. No, Chuck was legit. Superstar, top 10, you know, some years top 5 level player in this league for multiple years. The energy he brought to the game and to his team, you know, his willingness to, and he was a better player than people realize. It wasn't just undersized dude grabs rebounds. Now, Chuck could play make. He could make plays. He wasn't a great shooter. He was not a great shooter, but he could make passes. He could defend when he felt like it. He did not feel like it every night, but there were nights where he was engaged and locked in. But the effort and the energy and, you know, he made other teams react to him. And when he had better players around him, you saw how good he could be. Chuck was all that. He really was for a very long time.
Yeah, you think you were charitable calling him 6'4¾". I think you were charitable calling those Sixers teams good, not great. Ah. That dude was out there with, like, Mo Cheeks, a very nice man who was a very good player. But, like, it like that's basically the next best dude after, like, Doc retires and Mo gets traded. Like, that barely counts.
No, those teams, I mean, the Hersey Hawkins teams with Rick Mahorn and Mike Jaminski, like I said, good, but not great. You know what I mean? Like they were not the worst, but they were far from the best, you know, and that it showed because they couldn't get past Chicago and Boston in the playoffs, but they made the playoffs, you know, and Chuck was there every year, year after year, trying to will those teams a level or two higher than they probably should have been.
Now, that last Philly team, possibly the worst. Like, that would be a fair characterization.
My boy Chuck said one night, they're killing MJ for not making Scottie Pippen better and Horace Grant better. I got to make Sheldon Jones better.
Yeah, but fair point. Fair point. Right? Like, that is actually, like, him saying that is, like, Allen Iverson gave a spin on it in the whole practice press conference, where actually, to me, the funniest thing that he said is when he leaned up on the microphone, and I think it was Ashley Fox who asked the question, and he looked at her and said, now, how the hell am I supposed to make my teammates better by practicing? Right? Like, the idea, he's like, no, you don't understand.
Right.
They are as good as they are. Right? Like right. Charles said this. He's like, you talking about making James Worthy better. He's James Worthy.
Right.
You want me to make Mark Ivoroni better.
Right. There's no better. This is it. This is what we got. You know, so, yeah. So, Chuck, I used to feel so bad. Bob Ford, who just retired at the Philly Inquirer, who I've known for a long time. Good dude. He's from D.C., actually. But it was the columnist there. In the old days, Bob and I were beat writers together. So I covered the Bullets back then. They were the Bullets for the Post. And he was in Philly covering the Sixers. And Bob would just stand there at Chuck's locker, knowing what I was there to do was to try to provoke Chuck into saying something crazy that I could write. And Chuck wouldn't rise to the bait for 5-10 minutes. And I just knew, I just got to wait him out. He's going to say it. I know he's going to say it. I just keep poking him like every reporter from out of town would do back in those days. And then finally he would say something like that. And I go, ha, 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 write it down. And Bob would just look at me like, you MF-er. Now I gotta clean up this mess tomorrow after this latest thing that Chuck said to somebody else from out of town. Chuck was great, man. Like, I never, God, how many dozen times did I go up to Philly? Chuck, please fill up my notebook so I can write something good. And he did it every time, every single time.
Now, we talked about Charles and playing for those bad teams, and he did eventually ask for a trade, but I don't recall him saying, I ain't coming. That is what the Sixers are dealing with right now, except the thing is, I feel like they don't actually want the guy to come no matter what they say. So, like, in your NBA time, do you have anything comparable to what's happening here with Ben Simmons? Because on all the levels, I can't compare this to anything myself.
I would have to really sit down and think about it because I'm sure there's something comparable. The difference is I don't recall a player of his stature doing this. You know, I know there's been guys who've held out for contracts, new deals back in the day, or, you know, unsigned, but all-star guy who's a critical part of a team. Nah, see, Scotty never held out. Scotty would say, I want to be traded. Scotty would say, my contract sucks. Y'all got to give me a better deal. But he showed up, Bo, to your point. Like, he showed up for work. He's unhappy, but he showed up for work. You know what I mean? So I can't offhand think of anything that's comparable to this.
We could even start with, I can't think of a basketball player at this point in his career to get a Steve Blass situation, right? Like, yeah. We could point to Nick Anderson, for example. Like, with Fultz, we found out that there's some sort of injury that was there. And Nick Anderson, after he missed those shots, was right. never quite the same player.
Right.
But
right.
I've never seen a player as good as Ben Simmons with the offensive temperament that he has that gets us to the point where we are now, where the poor Sixers are like, the problem with us trading him, because I think they probably love to trade him, but they're going to get worse. Like, you can't pretend like the dude's not good because they can't make a trade with him that's going to make him better this year.
Right. It's a dilemma because he is so flawed that you're not going to get the return on investment that you would get if he was just a minus player offensively. You know what I mean? Like, if he was just kind of mediocre offensively, you could ask for and get what you should get for a player of his caliber. But because he's so flawed, because a team that trades for him would have to completely build their team around, they'd have to be willing to do it, right? The comp to me is Iverson, ironically enough, because the Sixers realized AI's got flaws. He's not going to guard nobody. You know, he's not a good percentage shooter. He's a high volume shooter, low percentage shooter, but he's so explosive that it's worth it. But they have to build a team around him, and they did, but it wasn't sustainable. So they got four dudes that didn't want to shoot. They didn't care about offense. We'll just play defense. Mutombo, I'll just play defense. Eric Snow, I'll just play defense. Aaron McKay, I'll just play defense. I don't care. I don't need to score. Jumaine Jones, I'll just play defense. It's so hard to find guys like that. Now, the irony with Simmons is that you would have to build them around four offensive guys in all likelihood. You know what I mean? Like, you'd have to have four guys that all can shoot to make up for the fact that he can't. And it's just hard to win that way. And so Ben is a very tough player to build a team around. It's not impossible, but you have to have a really unique collection of players to build around him.
From the beginning, when they decided to put those two guys together, like, I'm not even second guessing, when they drafted Simmons, I was like, you know, at some point the Sixers are going to have to start getting guys that fit together rather than just getting guys, because they had just taken Okafor the year before. And yeah. I was like, okay, Okafor and Embiid really doesn't work, but I don't see how Simmons works with any of those guys. But they kept it going longer than I expected. And I also think, and this is where it gets wild, is why we're talking about Simmons in the context of his limitations. I always thought the thing that was going to hit Simmons was the great Peter Tosh line, Ja did not put I on this earth to be a backup singer. Right? You know? Embiid, right. Like, I don't know why more people don't talk about this. Trust the Process used to be about this big old thing. Embiid woke up one day and decided, I am the Process. They call me the Process in warm-ups. Right. This ain't the Process. I am the Process. Right, right. And I know that Ben Simmons didn't have a vote on that.
No,
right? Like, I know he couldn't have been cool with that.
No, he was not. He was not. They will never cop to this, but I believe from day one that the guy that Joel vibed with was Markelle Fultz. I've always believed that. That was his guy. They were the guys that kind of hung together. They were the guys that kind of grew up together. They rehabbed together because they were both hurt at the time. And I don't think he ever rocked with Simmons like that. You know, I'm not there every day. I'm sure they will deny it. I'm sure he'll say, no, that's my guy. I love him. You don't say that about a guy you love after a playoff series.
Nah. Well, also, let me tell you this. Ain't nobody else expressed no love for that dude neither. Like, it does not seem to be a Joel Embiid thing. But, like, you know, I felt bad for Embiid in that moment because, like, how long am I supposed to keep lying, right? Like, you know, was there a turning point? You know damn well what the turning point was. Like, you talked about you were trying to get Charles Barkley to fill up your notebook. Somebody decided, I'm going to do this for the team, y'all. You think there was a turning point, Joel? Did something happen that maybe alter the direction of, do you remember anything?
Can you think of anything? Anything come to mind? May have like shunted the momentum.
Can you imagine at that moment when Embiid saw that? Like, it was actually a wonder in that moment that you didn't see more guys on the floor just lose their shit. Right. Like, what?
Give you the Marbury face, like, you know what I mean?
Oh, he's on back with Marbury's playing for the Nets and hitting guys in the face with the ball.
Right.
It just feel like, what did I do here? Like,
you know what I mean? So that's like, yeah, that was So that it's untenable then. It's untenable now. I don't have a good solution for Philly on this because you're going to get relatively pennies on the dollar no matter what you trade for, because ain't nobody giving you 4 first-round picks for Ben Simmons. That's insane. Even Minnesota, who's desperate, you know, isn't going to give you 4. So we'll see. We'll see. I mean, I've said this, so I'll be, in the sake of being consistent, I think Sac could make the best deal for Philly because Sac's got multiple guys, whether it's, you know, Buddy Hield would have to be in the deal, obviously. But, you know, any one of those 3 point guards that they now have, you know, I don't think you can play 3 point guards together. We'll see, you know, but either Fox or Mitchell got addressed last year. I'm blanking on
Halliburton.
Name. Halliburton, yeah. One of those 3 guys would have to be in the deal, I would think, along with Hield and maybe a couple of firsts. Now, that to me is not a great deal, but I think it's a decent deal. I think it's a decent return for Philly. I mean, Buddy does help them in terms of spreading the floor around Embiid. I mean, he's a legit shooter that people would have to account for. Now, could you play him and Danny Green together? I don't know. You know, you could get a decent return, and one of those point guards would help Philly. Any one of those 3 would help Philly, I think, a great deal. So, to me, Sac's the team that makes sense. Now, we'll see if that happens, but that's the one team I think that makes sense, because Golden State's not going to give you. They're not giving you any of those guys that you would want.
Okay. Right.
You know what I mean? Like, none of them. You're not getting Wiseman. You're not getting either of the rookies this year. And Philly is in win now, so they wouldn't even really want either of the rookies this year. So, yeah, there's no deal out there other than Sac to me that would make sense for Philly.
Speaking of the Warriors, has anyone sounded less sure of himself and less passionate while claiming he was going to fight for what he believes in than Andrew Wiggins did when he was explaining his vaccine situation?
Yeah, it was cringeworthy to me. Now, I have a position on vaccines that would make that cringeworthy, right? There are maybe others who disagree and, you know, my body, my choice people. That was not convincing on any level to me, you know? So I can't imagine. I think Steph made it quite clear what his line of demarcation was, and it's not where Andrew's standing, okay? So Andrew has a decision to make, you know what I mean? Because I haven't checked with lawyers, people who would deal in this sort of thing, but I think Golden State would have a reasonable case to make. We are under no obligation to pay a dude who shows up half the time his full salary. We just aren't, you know? And it's not because he's injured. It's a choice not to play because he won't get this vaccine. That's a choice. No matter how you couch it, it's a choice. I choose not to play because these are the rules under which I can play, and I choose not to abide by these rules. You know what I mean? So that, to me, is we're going to an arbitrator, and I'm yanking half your salary this year.
Yo, he is a walking argument against guaranteed salaries, right? Like, I'm not trying to make the argument for the opposition here.
Right,
but,
right.
I mean, I have always said about Andrew Wiggins, people get mad at me about this, but I think that the numbers and performance bear it out. He's a bust hiding in plain sight. Like, he doesn't look like a bust. But when you put it all together, considering the hype that surrounded him coming in, where he was the best prospect since LeBron in the eyes of a lot of people, and it never, ever quite came together. He makes $1 zillion, and I don't blame him for that. But a dude like him on a team like the Warriors, like, he got a whole new lease on life. Yeah. A guy like that is normally, I'm the first person in line to go get this vaccine.
Right.
He's like, man, my money ain't going nowhere. And so he sat up there, and he's another one that you have to remember isn't young anymore.
Yeah.
You know, because, like, you know, these guys that come in, so they come in so early now, and he still looks young. But then you realize this dude's like 26, 27 years old, and he had nothing about himself when he said that. Like, if you don't want to take the vaccine, you can make an argument for me that if you're willing to do it and put up with all the other stuff, okay, and you're going to live a disciplined life, cool, that's what you want to do. But when it came time to explain it, he was just like, I'm going to fight for what I believe in. And basically, they're like, what do you believe in? It's none of your business.
Right.
What? Like, you got to be able to give something.
That's a preposterous take for a public figure who makes what Andrew Wiggins makes. I'm sorry. It's preposterous to say that's none of your business. You know, was it none of our business when you got the bag? You know what I'm saying? You know, like you got the bag in plain sight. Why can't you talk about this in plain sight? You know what I mean? Like, you know, you get the endorsements in plain sight. You can't talk about this in plain sight. You know, so it's not one-sided. It's everything. And some of that is unfair, I grant you. But that's the life you choose to lead. You know, you choose to live a life in the public eye. Then all of it's in the public eye. You know what I mean? So, and that's not, he's not entitled to privacy. But he has to have an answer to that question. Here's what I believe and why I believe it. If you want to say it's because of Tuskegee, okay. You can make that argument, and you just don't trust the medical profession to do the right thing, okay. I would counter that that should also extend to medical treatments that you've received over the course of your career from doctors and from medical people who have operated on your body.
Yes. The least trustworthy doctors in the world, doctors that are paid by your bosses.
Exactly. Exactly. And you've gone along with what they recommended. You know what I'm saying? So there's a disconnect, I think, from some of these guys who talk about this as if they've never received medical treatment from team doctors before, or any doctors for that matter. They just happen to be in a business where they're in constant contact with the medical community on a daily basis about treatment, about rejuvenation, about supplements, about diet, about all of it. So they're right about everything except this one thing that requires an explanation.
Yeah.
You know, it requires an explanation. I don't have to agree with your explanation, but it requires you to have one, you know. And he just shuts it off, and it just doesn't work.
Speaking of people who defy explanation, we have Kyrie Irving. And I try to be careful in talking about Kyrie just because I think that people can often go too far in the other
sure.
direction. And I don't want to be confused with those people when talking about Kyrie. But my wonder with him is Harden and Durant still got his back through all of this.
Yes.
Are you amazed that they're not tired of it? Because that shocks me.
Well, you know, KD is loyal to Kyrie. I'll just put it that way. Their relationship, their friendship is a legitimate one. It's a real one. So KD's going to rock with Kyrie. And okay, I respect that. I respect the fact that's your guy. You're going to roll with your guy. Okay. I don't know about Harden. I don't know that Harden and Kyrie have a, you know, close relationship. If James is simply looking at it from the standpoint of we need this dude to help me get a chip. Okay. That's fair. You know, like I get it. Like at some point, he's going to have to do what he does. Because somebody's hurt or somebody's in foul trouble. If we're going to win this playoff game, Kyrie has to go nuts and I got to have him on my side. Cool. I get it. So it doesn't surprise me because there's so much pressure on Brooklyn this year to win it all. They got the red shirt year when Durant was hurt. Nobody cared. Last year they had the injury excuse because everybody got hurt. You're running out of reasons you haven't won one yet. You know what I mean? So you got to break through, and this is the year to break through. So I'm sure it's September. They can be magnanimous in September. If he has missed 16 home games by January 1st, they may not be as magnanimous. So we'll see on that one.
Yeah, the indicator I've gotten from talking to somebody around Durant is they're like, man, he going to play. He going to play. And yeah. I just can't imagine myself personally being that confident and saying I know what the hell Kyrie Irving going to do, whether it's good or bad.
Well,
I am never in a position to be like, I know what he's going to do. I do not.
Right. You know, he could play for a week, you know, and then just say, nah, I don't feel like playing. When I say that, I'm not being dismissive of him or critical of him. He's just one of these dudes that, you know, he just is going to do what he feels like doing when he wakes up that morning. There's no rhyme or reason to it. There's no planning for it, you know. And so you have to kind of decide that I'm cool living in that space where Kyrie just might wake up one morning and say, you know what? I just don't feel like playing this week. You know, it's just not in me this month. You know, and he's just going to be gone until he wakes up another morning and says, yeah, I'm ready to go. And that's just kind of who he is. And Bo, I'm with you. I don't want to pile on and say that Kyrie is, you know, a ridiculous person because I don't think he is. I think he's trying to figure out who he is and what's important to him. I think that's pretty clear and obvious. I don't think I'm really going out on a limb to say that. And I don't know how important basketball is to him. I think he loves playing, but I don't think he likes everything that comes with basketball. You know, and with pro basketball, certainly. And so he's wrestling with that. And I have said and written, when he took the stand against the N-word, I was right with him, 100%. But I'm not going to agree with Kyrie on everything. And this is one of these cases where I don't get it. If you purport to want to win a championship and you do not want to be a distraction, then why are you being a distraction?
I would actually prefer it if he were a ridiculous person.
Exactly.
Because then this could be fun. Like the one thing that the last 15 or 20 years or so of NBA basketball that's happened that we don't talk about nearly enough is these guys aren't nearly as hilarious in just some like completely out there characters as you used to have in the NBA. So many people have probably heard this famous story that Bob Costas tells about sitting at an airport gate with Marvin Barnes. And it's a flight that's going across time zones.
Yeah,
and
east to central.
Yeah. And so it's like a 7 o'clock flight, but you land at 6:55 and Marvin Barnes looks at Costas and says, hey, bro, I ain't getting on no time machine. Now, he was obviously intentionally trying to be funny and all of that, but like, right. Those are the stories we used to tell about NBA players. Just amazing things right. like this. That there's a time where Kyrie and all his Kyrie-ness perfectly fits in the NBA aesthetic, except those guys who were like that didn't take themselves so seriously. Like, that's where we get the deviation. It's like, no, please, if you were ridiculous, we could all be ridiculous. But Kyrie is absolutely, at least to himself, not being ridiculous.
Yes. I mean, it's a case of, you know, really wanting, I think, to be thought of as a deep thinker, right? As a thoughtful person. And so when you say, it's not that I believe the earth is flat, I just want you to start questioning everything. Okay, but, you know, there's a limit to that. You can question everything if you want. You can question, why do we keep time? You know what I mean? Like, why, you know, why do we give blood? Why do we have democratic representative government? Why do we stop foraging in the, you know what I mean? Like, you can take this to a ridiculous extreme. You know what I mean? Like, you can question everything if you choose to, but this society, as flawed as it is, we've kind of all agreed that when the light turns red, we stop driving. You know what I mean? Like, we kind of all just have agreed that that's what we do to make this not anarchy. You know? So at some point, you have to kind of accept that there are things that we generally agree upon that have to happen for this thing to kind of work, sort of, you know, like, and he just doesn't seem to be there.
Now, most people aren't built to be autodidactic. Right? So Ta-Nehisi Coates is an autodidact. The great example. Did not graduate from college and talks about all the struggles that he had in school.
Yeah.
But he has been able to teach himself like a multitude of things and has become the man that he is right now because he is capable of doing that. I ain't really so much built like that. Like I can figure stuff out, but I don't think I'm built to like teach myself how to do all these things. What I learned in school is, A, what are the questions that people have already asked? And B, how do you come up with what the new questions are? And I do wonder sometimes with these guys who didn't go to college that there's a measure of insecurity that has to come up because you don't have this certification that society says, oh, we'll listen to you now.
Right,
and so
right.
now you need to demonstrate that you are a person to be listened to. And a big part of how you do that is then by saying, what's wrong with this other path? And, you know, you guys are just being fed this stuff and you're just doing everything else. And yeah, there's some people that's like that, but that's not what the game is supposed to be. Yeah. And so Kyrie gets on the super deep kick. And I told you, man, he was wearing them Unk earrings when he did media availability. And I was like, oh, you're at that step in your journey. Some of the homies out here who have a lot of Unk stuff and tattoos were like, oh, man, what you saying? I'm saying the dude is wearing Unk earrings. That's what I'm saying. Line up everybody you know, man in particular, because women got all kinds of earrings that go all over the place. Dudes normally got maybe a hoop. But it's a stud of some sort, right? We'll tend to have, like, you know, George Michael and Barry Bonds with the cross. Yeah, I get you. But we normally don't put designs up in there. Line up every dude you know with an Unk earring or two. Line them all up and ask them some questions. And guess what? They all going to sound just like Kyrie Irving. Maybe not every single one. But the one who doesn't sound like him is going to be like, damn, I need some new earrings.
Right. There's some truth. There's no universal truth, but I think there is some truth in the notion. The one thing that I learned in college was just critical thinking. That's all. Trying to solve something in a myriad of different ways. You know what I mean? From a myriad of different angles. And it doesn't mean I'm smarter than Kyrie Irving. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that's a skill set. That's something in my bag that maybe others don't have or they didn't have it as much. It's just kind of what I learned. Other people learn different things, time management and all kinds of things in college. You know, I didn't learn time management. I'm just as late for everything as I've always been. But, you know, so that's what I learned. I've always said, even through osmosis, if you're in college for however long you're in college, I think you learn something. You know, there could be some of that there with not just Kyrie, but other guys who are, you know, kind of on that path. And it's okay. And I've said this, but it's okay to be still learning. You know, it's okay. I'm not saying it's wrong for him to kind of think about things and say, well, what's my place in the world? What's my place in this particular thing? You know, and again, he's talked about things and done things that cannot let you dismiss him. You know, the work he's done with the Native American community, the work he's done with the WNBA, you can't dismiss him, okay? You can try, you can do it to make yourself feel better, but you'd be wrong. And that's why when he says some of the things he says, you just aren't sure where this is coming from.
Last thing I want to ask you as we start wrapping this thing here up, is there an NBA story? Because I think this is a really interesting NBA season. Like, yeah. Is there anything really just kind of jumping out to you? They're like, oh, that's the thing I want to see.
A couple of things. One is the Celtics, because I can't figure them out. Like, I don't know if they're going to be sneaky good or if it's not going to work. Just because Brad Stevens was a pretty good coach. He ain't never been a GM before. And Ime Udoka, everybody thinks he's going to be a good head coach, but this is his first year, you know? And so the moves that they made, some of them I like, some of them I'm like, I'm not sure. I'm just curious how it's all going to work out this year with them, because it's so new, and the kind of moves that they made kind of made changes, bringing Horford back and things like that. I'm just agnostic about them. I'm curious to see how it all works out, or maybe doesn't work out. I don't know. In the East, you can't say they're a top three team, but they're not a lottery team, clearly, right? So what are they? It's going to be interesting to me to see how that plays out and pans out over the course of the season. And of course, the Lakers, you know, you just want to see how team geriatric does. You know what I mean? Because I think they could actually be good. But it could also be comically bad if everybody gets hurt, which is a distinct possibility with guys that old. It just is. It's not that they're not trying and they didn't come to camp in shape. It's that old guys get hurt in the NBA. That's what happens to old guys. They get hurt and it's harder and it takes longer for them to come back.
And how much are they counting off Russell Westbrook, who is one of my all-time favorite players, and he's going to fill up that stat sheet. But I said on Twitter yesterday, he is better on the stat sheet than he is on the court. Like, I thought he provided a particular value to the Wizards because he is such a sturdy leader dude. Yes. Like, that is a dude that young dudes can learn all kinds of stuff from. Lakers ain't got no young dudes.
Right. That is the question. Russell's gifts, his energy, his passion, his demands on younger team like the Wizards were last year that hadn't won jack, hadn't done jack, that has an impact because those guys start to play harder, they start to prepare harder, they start to pay more attention to detail, and they wound up going on this incredible streak. That's not what the Lakers need. On the other hand, Russell can provide what they need, which is 82 games of regular season energy. Like, he's going to play hard, whether they play in Memphis or Toronto or Charlotte, it does not matter. He's going to play hard. And play hard is something that they need. LeBron's never going to cop to it, but, you know, he needs somebody that can help him get through a regular season.
He's old, man. There's no way around it.
That's it. He old. He old. You know, AD gets hurt a lot. You know, he gets hurt a lot. And so Russell can help them win games that maybe they would give away in a different year so that they have a little bit better seeding going into the playoffs. And maybe they avoid the play-in. You know what I mean? So that's where he can help them. And then what will be interesting to me, Bo, is what do they do in the playoffs with Russell? Because it is hard to play Russell on the floor big minutes in the playoffs just because of his shooting deficiencies. The same issue as with Ben Simmons. It's just hard. It's hard because Russ will shoot. It's not a problem of shooting. He'll shoot it. Ben don't want to shoot it. Russell will shoot it. He just won't make it a whole lot. You know what I mean? From the outside. So people come, you know, they play under every screen and roll. They dare him to shoot. And he does. And so that will be interesting to me. 5 minutes left down two. I mean, I assume he's on the floor. What is he doing on the floor? Like, what are they going to ask him to do? Is he going to screen away? I don't know. That, to me, will be the fascinating part of that team this year.
Man, we got so much. Like, Klay Thompson coming back to the Warriors, and I think people are expecting too much from a dude that just had two debilitating injuries to come back. Like, look, they had a five-year run. Five-year run is 1 or 2 years longer than most runs ever are. You know, you know, so we'll see where that goes. But, man, every time I get in talking about the NBA, I always feel like the most under-discussed team is always the same one, and it's Denver. And my big – I don't even know if it's a hot take, but – they just gave Michael Porter Jr. all that money. And people are like, oh, if you're Denver, you have to give that guy that money. Anybody would have given that dude that money. Like, it is entirely possible that the Nuggets had the MVP last year and Michael Porter Jr. could make the superstar leap this year. He's 6'10", shooting 45% from three and can get his own shot. If that happens, and they get, you know, even with Murray being hurt, if that happens and they get some decent health from everybody else, whoo, that's going to be fun. If nothing else, it's going to be fun.
Denver's a favorite to me, one of the favorites in the West for sure, even with Jamal being out because of Michael Porter Jr., of course, and Jokic coming back. I was a little surprised, but I thought they would try to bring in a veteran guard just to kind of help them get through the season. I'm not saying that Campazzo and Rivers and those guys aren't good. I'm not saying that. I'm saying over 82, are you going to get enough out of that group of guards? to kind of offset Murray being out most of the year, if not all of the year. Because again, those three or four games make all the difference between hosting and being on the road. And I think that does make a difference in the playoffs. Not as big a difference as you may think, but it does make some difference. I'm not saying that they can't. I'm saying I don't know, and I want to see that over the course of the season. But I agree with you. I think, Mike, he is so unique in this league in terms of what he does and how he does it. Man, he's really good. And again, with him, it's all about health and staying healthy and being out on the court. But the drop-off is not that great with him on the floor as your number two. It's not.
Nah, I forgot about that whole Composito situation. Silly me for assuming that they looked around and were like, hey, we should probably step up a little bit at this position. And yeah, they did not.
Yeah, it didn't have to be. To me, it didn't have to be like they. I'm not saying they had to go spend $20 million on a superstar.
But apparently you could have got Dennis Schroeder for $25 an hour.
Well, you know, and maybe it's not. Maybe they looked at him and he didn't like the fit or whatever. But yeah, someone like that, they could just help you. You know what I mean? Like, you're not asking them to carry the load. You're just asking them to be part of the piano movers. You know what I mean? So, I just thought they would bring someone in who could help them kind of get through the regular season. But they're going to rock with the guys that they had in the playoffs last year. So, okay, we'll see.
Hey, man, that is David Aldridge. Check him out at theathletic.com. Also, again, he's the star of the PTI 20 documentary the ESPN just did on the 20 years of part of the interruption. Man, I always appreciate when you give us a little time, man. Thank you so much.
Bo, anytime, man. Love you, man, and love what you're doing as always. Keep it up and, you know, stay safe out there, bro.
Hey, appreciate it, man. And ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this three times a week. Gabe Bassain and Dave Presley handling everything behind the scenes. Thank you, gentlemen. Remember, follow The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. And we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or follow on the ESPN app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.